Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the account that lets you send, spend, and receive money internationally. Wise is the best way to move and manage your money around the world, all with one account. It's for saving in dollars, pesos, baht, and more. It's for sending money back home fast and makes vacation spending in the local currency simple. You'll always get the mid-market exchange rate when you convert currencies, with no markups and no hidden fees. It's one account built for your international life. Join 15 million customers and learn how the Wise account could work for you by downloading the app or visiting wise.com/world.
The U.S. military has carried out airstrikes against Iranian-backed groups in Syria. Meanwhile, in Israel, soldiers are waiting for orders about the next phase of the war. I'm Carol Hills. Also in Israel, thousands of farm workers from Thailand are caught up in the hostilities with Hamas.
This has brought about condemnation in the private circles. It's pretty intense.
Also today, tens of thousands of migrants from Haiti are taking charter flights to Nicaragua. Some say the Nicaraguan government is cashing in on human misery.
There is a business interest on them to promote this type of arrangements.
And why do people keep getting these two European countries mixed up?
Leaders and citizens of Switzerland, this is a message from Sweden.
All those stories and more coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. Thanks for being with us on this Friday. The Pentagon says the U.S. military carried out airstrikes in Syria last night, targeting Iranian-backed militias based in the eastern part of the country. A senior U.S. official said F-16s attacked weapons and ammunition storage areas and that these sites were connected to Iran's Revolutionary Guard. In the past 10 days, U.S. military bases in Syria and Iraq have been hit by a string of drone and rocket attacks. To understand what's happened and where this could all be headed, we're turning to Emma Beals in London. She's a senior advisor with the European Peace Institute and an expert on Syria. Emma, what do we know about these U.S. airstrikes last night?
Well, they were very limited in scope, and they were basically used as a deterrent in the hopes that after more than 20 attacks, which have injured more than 20 US personnel this month, both in Syria and Iraq, that those groups who operate both in Syria and Iraq would stop targeting US troops. That's probably not going to be the response, but it will sort of, at worst, it continues as a sort of tit for tat operation of relatively minor strikes on both sides.
You know, it's interesting. A lot of Americans might be surprised to hear that the U.S. still has military bases in Syria and in Iraq. What's the mission of American forces there right now?
Well, in both countries, the mission is part of the Defeat ISIS coalition, which was formed obviously in response to ISIS when they swept across both of those countries around 10 years ago. In Iraq, U.S. troops are there at the invitation of the government. So the combat mission against ISIS in Iraq ended in 2021, but they are still there helping defeating ISIS in terms of making sure that the former fighters are dealt with, that there's reintegration, that's training of Iraqi troops and so on. There is still an ISIS presence in Syria. It's not in the areas predominantly where US troops are based, but they are there to continue to be a deterrent factor and train and support those who are trying to continue to sort of defeat ISIS in both of those countries, which is obviously, you know, a core policy goal of the United States.
Tell us more about these Iranian-backed militia groups in Iraq and Syria. I mean, who are they and what do they want?
Iran has sort of been expanding across the region. You know, they have proxy forces in a lot of these countries, in Lebanon, in Syria, and in Iraq. Iran itself has been a very strong supporter of the president there in his, you know, in the civil war that's been happening, both directly and through sort of militias. So they have a huge sort of stake in conflict, and they are involved with some of the militias in that eastern part of the country towards where the US troops are. And what they want is to sort of exert pressure on the United States. I mean, the Pentagon has said that they do expect there to be a prospect for more significant escalation against US forces and personnel across the region. They've sent more troops out there as a result. They have warships in the area as well to try and deter that thing, those events.
If the US, Russia, and Iran all have military forces in Syria, where does the Syrian government stand in all this?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, they are still in control ostensibly of the country. Syria is divided into four areas of control. The Syrian government controls one of those areas. It does have some of the larger cities. But this has been one of the questions for quite a long time, right, is the degree to which they can even extract themselves from Russia and Iran. And I think the answer is that they cannot. Those countries have supported them and helped them with their brutal military campaign to maintain their power through the war. And so they cannot really extract themselves from either of those countries.
You know, the U.S. says these strikes against Syria, that they're not an expansion of the Gaza war. But are you still worried that this could become a regional conflict that involves the U.S.?
Well, I think the U.S. has been clear that these are a deterrent. They would be hoping to keep any sort of direct kinetic engagement like this at a small level. But they're obviously worried that this could become broader because they have warships in the region, obviously, to deter wider engagement. And you've seen huge diplomatic efforts by the U.S. and others as well to try to make sure that this doesn't become, you know, a far, far broader conflict across the region. But at the moment, you know, the region is at a boiling point. So it is, of course, of great concern to everybody living, working on and in the Middle East that there really is the chance that this could get larger.
Emma Beals is a senior advisor with the European Peace Institute and an independent consultant on Syria. She joined us from London. Thanks a lot, Emma.
Thank you.
When Hamas gunmen attacked communities in southern Israel on October 7th, they took around 200 people hostage, bringing them back through the border fence and into Gaza. The hostages are believed to be hidden in underground tunnels. The latest information from the Israeli government says that more than half of these captives are citizens of other countries. Many of them are dual nationals. As the world's Patrick Wynn reports from Bangkok, the largest number of foreigners among the hostages are farm workers from Thailand.
Sontia Sangram felt very far from home. He was in a kibbutz in Israel 2 weeks ago, listening to air raid sirens, watching what looked like fireballs streaking across the dark sky. He says they were rockets fired by Hamas. Sontia was recording the attack on his phone. He saw his friend, also from Thailand, standing outside, and he yelled, "Hey, get over here, under the shelter."
Hey, daddy.
Seconds later, impact. We've been terrified, Sontia tells me. Paranoid, too. And by we, he means the roughly 30,000 Thai farmers in Israel. Most, like Sontia, are Buddhists from Thailand's rural upcountry. They could make a pittance farming back home or come to Israel and make $2,000 a month. In Thailand, that's more than many professors make. Sontia is 30, and he works at a kibbutz south of Tel Aviv, growing strawberries for an Israeli boss. He's been praying that Israel's missile defense system blocks all those Hamas rockets. He says, "We've seen Israel shoot these interception missiles. It's called Iron Dome, right?" This is all very new to him. Sontia was barely aware of Hamas until its fighters stormed into other kibbutz farming areas, killing 1,400 people. An estimated 24 were Thais. Hamas also kidnapped 54 Thais, according to the Israeli government. No other foreign country has so many captives held in Gaza. Sontia says, "What Hamas did, it's not fair to the Thai hostages. We don't even know about Hamas. Now all Thai people are boiling with anger." Sean Boonprakong, a former Thai national security advisor, says that sums up what many Thai people are feeling.
Thai said, "Why did this happen?" They begin to understand religious conflict in the Middle East. It's a really quick education.
There's a reason Israel brings in so many Thai farmers. Palestinians used to do these farming jobs, but in the 90s, in the wake of the first Intifada, or Palestinian uprising, Israel's government restricted Palestinians crossing out of Gaza. So Israel brought in guest workers, and many are from rural Thailand. They're skilled at agriculture, they're used to hot weather, and as Buddhist, according to Sean Boonprakong, the Israel-Palestine conflict holds little interest to most Thai farmers.
They're mostly apolitical. This has brought about condemnation in the private circles. It's pretty intense.
Thailand has a new prime minister, Setha Thawisin, just 2 months into the job. This has emerged as his biggest political test so far, negotiating to free the hostages. In the meantime, he's asked all Thais to leave Israel, and more than 4,000 have. But Sonthia Sangram is not one of them, much to the frustration of his wife. My wife is upset, he says. She's like, just come home. You can always go back to Israel when the war's over. But the money's too good, he says. It justifies the hardships. Farming in the desert heat, living in a shipping container with a Thai farming crew, even Hamas rockets. When Sonthia spoke to me on the phone, it was dark outside, just before dawn. It's 5:53 in the morning, he says. Time for me to get to work. Reporting in Bangkok, this is Patrick Nguyen for The World.
Rugby fans have had plenty to watch over the last several weeks as the Rugby World Cup has filled stadiums across France. The tournament comes to an end this weekend, but this final week of play has brought some controversy. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
The final game is underway.
England and South Africa have a history of rivalry at the World Cup. They battled for the top spot in 2007 and again in 2019 when the Brits looked stronger than ever. In the final minutes of that match, though, the Springboks surged ahead, surprising some fans and taking home the trophy. So tensions were high when the two teams met again at this year's tournament.
South Africa trail England by 2 points. We'll have a reset.
During the match last weekend, England's Tom Curry approached a referee and asked what to do if he was called a racial slur.
Nothing, please.
Curry was accusing South Africa's Bongi Mbanambi of making the comment. In the moment, the game went on without pause, but World Rugby, the sport's global governing body, launched a formal review of the incident a few days later. Curry then came out and said Mbanambi had made the same racist comment to him during a game last year. As the investigation took place, England's managers stood by Curry and insisted he experienced racially abusive behavior. Mbanambi's team supported him, too, with coach Don Uman calling him a family man and a team leader.
He's a very, very humble guy, down-to-earth, very hard worker.
Kevin Hilton, a professor emeritus at Leeds Beckett University, points out that this isn't an isolated incident. He's studied the intersection of race and sport for decades.
Within sport, there are additional complications around this notion of acceptable discourse on the pitch or on the court or wherever it might be. And that, you know, once you say things, you walk off the pitch or the court and it stays there.
But it shouldn't stay there, Hilton adds. He says Curry was right to bring the alleged comment to the referee's attention. Hilton says there's also room for a nuanced conversation around race here, since a black man was accused of lodging a racial slur at a white man.
If Mbanambi used those racial slurs, I would be very, very disappointed. Because given where he hails from and given the history of South Africa, he's undermining the actual struggles of those who have been the subjects of institutionalized racism. So nobody should be throwing around racial slurs, not least somebody who's been impacted by that in the everyday and over generations.
World Rugby was expected to conclude their investigation after tomorrow's final. But yesterday, their ruling came down early.
World Rugby have concluded there is insufficient evidence to bring any charges against Mbogeni Mbanambi.
Insufficient evidence means Mbanambi is cleared to play. He and his fellow Springboks will face New Zealand in the Rugby World Cup final tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. World Rugby now considers the case closed unless more evidence comes to light. But they also say they believe Curry made the allegations in good faith, and there's no suggestion that the accusation was deliberately false or malicious. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Gang violence is going from bad to worse in Haiti, devastating the lives of people across the island. That's the grim reality, according to the United Nations, and it's why thousands of Haitians are taking charter flights to Nicaragua, with most planning eventually to reach the U.S. Some say the Nicaraguan government is taking advantage of a desperate situation in Haiti, as The World's Tibi Saizea reports.
In the past few months, the number of charter flights traveling between Haiti and Nicaragua has more than quadrupled. These flights are believed to be carrying Haitian migrants, tens of thousands of them. Ariel Ruiz is with the Migration Policy Institute.
What I know is that the number of Haitian migrants traveling through Nicaragua has been increasing for about a month and a half. So it is possible that some of this increase is due to more flights from Haiti to Nicaragua.
Nicaragua has long been used as a transit country for people fleeing Caribbean countries like Cuba and Haiti. And that's because it doesn't require any visas for them to enter. But charter flights are expensive. A seat can cost between $3,000 and $5,000. Ruiz says the fact that more Haitians are using this route might signal a different profile of migrants.
Now, because of the reported cost of these flights, we may be thinking about different migrants who can afford these expensive flights or are relying more on remittances from family abroad.
Some experts say another reason why more Haitians are taking this route is because there are more charter flights available to Nicaragua. Manuel Orozco, the director of migration at the Inter-American Dialogue, says the Nicaraguan government might be actually facilitating the operation of charter flights and profiting from it.
There is a business interest on them to promote this type of arrangements and to be part of the negotiation.
Nicaragua is one of the poorest countries in Latin America. Orozco estimates that the charter flights transporting migrants bring at least $5 million a month in revenue to the Nicaraguan airport authority.
It's a country that has isolated from the international community in alliance with Iran, with Russia, North Korea, and Venezuela to have an ideological stance against the United States. What the Nicaraguan government is doing is basically using migration as an exercise of hitting the United States.
But what's clear is that there are many Haitians trying to leave Haiti and their options are limited. The land border between Haiti and the Dominican Republic has been closed for over a month due to a water dispute, and many Haitians use Dominican airports to get out of the Caribbean island. Ariel Ruiz from the Migration Policy Institute says the number of migrants coming via charter flights to Nicaragua is relatively small compared to almost 500,000 migrants who this year alone have crossed the Darien Gap jungle that separates South and Central America. For The World, I'm Tibi Saizea.
A controversial new museum of forbidden art has just opened in Barcelona. All of the works on display, and or the artists themselves, have at some point been banned, canceled, or attacked for causing offense, which they do. The very act of describing the artwork forced us to censor the words of our very own reporter, just so we could put this story on the air. But listeners should note, they will hear references to several sexually explicit images. The World's Jerry Haddon bravely takes us to opening day at the museum.
What's not to be offended by? That's the question on the mind of Christine Schmidt. She's standing before a statue of a man who bears an uncanny resemblance to Spain's king emeritus, Juan Carlos. This, she says, is really disgusting, because the former king is on all fours and engaged in, let's just say, some very graphic sex with a Bolivian labor leader and a German shepherd. The sculpture by Austrian artist Ines Dujac is called Not Dressed for Conquering. A few years back, it was to be shown in an exhibit in Barcelona, but the museum pulled the plug under pressure. The sculpture hasn't been seen in public again until today.
Pero bueno, tenemos la libertad, ¿no? La libertad de expresión y bueno, hay que respetarla, ¿no?
We are all free to express ourselves, visitor Schmidt says. You have to respect that. I personally feel repelled by this, but that must be what the artist wanted, she says. Schmidt's reaction is what the owner of all this art wants. He's a local media mogul named Tacho Bennett.
Este museo podría llamarse perfectamente el Museo de la Tolerancia, porque creo que lo que hace justamente es...
I could have named this place the Museum of Tolerance, he tells me, because when people leave, they have the sense that they've beaten the censors. That's what Bennett hopes, anyway. He's holding court today with reporters from around the world. There's been a lot of buzz around this opening, and the place is packed.
Me encantaría poder decir que tuve una idea brillantísima y me convertí en una persona...
I'd love to take credit for this brilliant idea, Bennett says, but that's not the case. I just happened to buy a piece of art at a show in Madrid in 2018, he says, and 2 hours after I paid for it, it got censored. The censor was the very show that had sold him the piece. It's an annual art fest called Arco. The work features portraits of jailed Catalan separatists. Organizers gave it the kibosh, they said, because it created too much controversy, stole attention from other works. Bennett says the incident inspired him. He's now collected some 200 censored works. Some on display here are well known. For example, sexually explicit photos by American photographer Robert Mapplethorpe, or a portrait of executed Italian dissidents made entirely of Lego pieces by Chinese activist Ai Weiwei. And then there's this small oil-on-canvas portrait of Mexican revolutionary leader Emiliano Zapata riding his steed. In this version, he's naked, except for a pair of high heels and a pink sombrero. He looks like Freddie Mercury. I had to go into hiding, says the painter Fabian Chaires, because in Mexico's macho society, my feminizing of a national hero proved unacceptable. A bunch of national heroes take it on the chin here. Heroes or villains, depending on your perspective. There's an unflattering portrait of Donald Trump, also in his birthday suit, and there's Andy Warhol's Mao, in which the former Chinese leader is presented in makeup, and a life-size and scarily real replica of late Spanish dictator Francisco Franco, crammed inside a Coca-Cola vending machine. Of course, Mao and Franco are no longer around to hang those who might mock them, but sometimes ordinary citizens seek their own version of artistic justice.
Se llama Con Flores a María, que es un retrato en posición virginal del artista.
Lidia Peleno, spokeswoman for the museum, shows me one painting called With Flowers for Maria. It looks like a classic virgin staring up at the heavens, cherubs around her feet. It's by Spanish artist and feminist Charo Corrales, and two things about it stand out. First, she's engaged in a solo sex act. Second, there's a giant slash down the center of the canvas.
Un visitante en Córdoba que vio la exposición se ofendió porque la imagen es la, ella.
A visitor in Córdoba saw this at an exhibit and was offended, she says, so he attacked it with a box cutter. Peleno says they've left this piece damaged on purpose as a reminder of how censorship can play out, and no doubt to keep museum staff on alert. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon in Barcelona.
Denmark sees a problem with some immigrant neighborhoods. The government says they're too isolated from the mainstream, with people living in so-called parallel societies. So it's come up with a controversial plan.
If ever there was an example of state-led gentrification, I think this would be one of them.
That story is ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World, a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Internet and phone service in the Gaza Strip went down today under heavy bombardment by the Israeli military. And a spokesman said that Israeli ground forces are expanding their activities. More than 350,000 reserve troops have been mobilized for a possible invasion into Gaza. Gilad Shirir is one of them. He's a 45-year-old tax attorney and now a lieutenant colonel in the Israeli army. His unit is currently patrolling near Israeli communities just a few miles from the Gaza border.
I'm in the cities or towns around the Gaza Strip in the Be'eri, Alumim, Sa'ad, kibbutz area. You hear the bombings all the time, both on the Israeli side and on the Gaza side, and you understand that there's going to be an increase in the military activity. It feels very volatile because, you know, we don't know where it's going to end.
I imagine you must spend a lot of time thinking about what's next. Are you waiting for orders to begin a ground assault into Gaza? Is that what's foremost on your mind right now?
Everyone in Israel is waiting to see what's next. And I think that the main concern of, I think, almost every Israel citizen, whether on uniform or not, is thinking about the hostages and the kids, part of them already orphans, because we know what happened to their parents already, and the elderly. On the other hand, as a military unit, and specifically an infantry combat unit, you know, we're ready to do whatever it takes or whatever we will be asked to do.
You haven't been to Gaza, but when you hear stories about the spider web of tunnels beneath the territory, do you wonder what it would be like to fight there?
It definitely, it's going to be a huge challenge. We don't expect to fight under that sort of spider web of tunnels, but we might find ourselves there. We've been also practiced for handling, let's say, sort of underground tunnels. Again, I hope it won't come to that.
I understand you know people who were taken hostage. Is that right?
I know a parent who worked, a person who worked with me. His daughter was taken hostage from her house, her husband with her, and their two little kids.
Mm. Does that change how you think about the dangers of a ground invasion?
I do not think that necessarily we'll manage to see the hostages safely back home just based on ground assault. I think the ground assault's goals are different. And the hostage situation is handled on a different level. They all come to the same place. The Hamas terrorism, brutal, inhumane attack, which, you know, if you don't see the pictures and don't smell, literally smell the death on the streets, you can't understand it.
Gilad, you're with your unit near Gaza. What are your days like as you're waiting to find out what's next?
First 10 days, we saw the horrors and we were asked by the military and our commanders to walk into the towns and villages and try to help the civilians who were, you know, rushed out of homes. And you see the gunshots and you see the blood pools and you see the baby beds. And, you know, you sort of imagine and draw in your mind what happened there. And actually, there's not a lot of space for imagination when you walk in those houses. And those were the first 10 days. They were very challenging, I think, psychologically. And the last 10 days, we were more in let's say, a military, back to military work on patrols, guarding the border, because keep in mind that there's still a lot of bombings and you need the bomb shelters. So you can't just, you know, put up a tent and be a military base with tents because you're under attacks yourselves. And from there, we go out and do our military activity, which is mainly defense, protecting the borders, and we have our regiment has run into several terrorists which have still, even in recent days, tried to cross the border, tried to reach these towns, both on bikes and by foot, and we've identified them and stopped them. So I think that's part of our duty here. So that's how the days are. Very, very tense and you know, very, everyone's on edge. I think also a bit afraid, but also very, very secure in the fact that they know why they need to be here.
I'm sure you're also thinking about civilians in Gaza. Are you worried that the way Israel is waging this war will make peace with those civilian Palestinians more difficult?
I'm a bit ambivalent about that. You know, on the one hand, you know, you've got 3 million or so Gaza people, and not all of them are Hamas, and not all of them are terrorists. On the other hand, the majority, they're the majority, and they're led by that, and they're part of it. And if you can see or hear a call, which I just heard yesterday, I don't know if you got to hear it, and it's overwhelming, and you should even try to listen to it and even broadcast it, of a terrorist in a house in one of the towns here, calling his parents from a phone of a murdered girl, and having a live video chat with them and showing them and saying, hey, I just murdered 10 Jews, and his parents are celebrating in the background. And that's the discussion between a son and his parents. And how from there can you even think and talk about the peace? It's just hard to, you know, to accept or to understand. Again, like I say, like as a human being, that said, definitely any war that, you know, situation and bombings is going to make things harder, because there are going to be casualties in the Gaza side, and people are going to suffer from the Gaza side. And I think that that would definitely make things harder. I'm not sure that there's any better way currently in order to finish the Hamas attacks. I think that the Gaza Strip entirely and the Gaza people would probably be better off if they weren't led by this very brutal terrorist group. And hopefully once they are sort of migrated or taken out of the equation, then hopefully life would be balanced again and peace could come back here.
Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much. And hoping for better and quieter days.
Gilad Shirir is the battalion commander of a reserve unit not far from the Gaza Strip. He received authorization from the Israel Defense Forces to speak with us. The government in Denmark wants to transform its immigrant neighborhoods, and it's decided on a pretty radical approach. The plan is to tear down or sell off housing units in neighborhoods where more than half the population is from so-called non-Western origin. Rikke Skovgaard Nielsen is a senior researcher at Aalborg University in Denmark. She's speaking with us from the Danish capital, Copenhagen. Rikke, we'll get to this plan in a minute, but first, what's the perceived problem here that this idea aims to solve?
Well, the idea is that these neighborhoods where you have a concentration of immigrants, yes, and descendants, but also of people with low educational level and low income and higher levels of crime, that these neighborhoods are somehow parallel societies. The implication is that it's away from some sort of cultural norms that are Danish or different in a negative way from how we are supposed to live our life in Denmark. So in that sense, it's more in terms of getting people to live more of the Danish way, not religiously, but in terms of cultural norms.
So describe the government's plan to dismantle these, quote, non-Western neighborhoods.
These plans have mainly been lists that kind of stigmatize the areas by calling them different kinds of names, such as deprived neighborhoods, etc. Then in 2018, a new legislation was passed. And this legislation means that for the most deprived areas, areas that were originally called hard ghettos, but are now called restructuring or transformation areas, in these areas, we have to tear down units. So it's social housing areas, and they have to go from 100 to 40% social housing, either by selling units or by tearing down units, transforming them into more of a mixed tenure neighborhood. At the same time, they are changing the allocation criteria for these neighborhoods so that if you are unemployed, you cannot move into the areas, which also means that if you're in a building that's being torn down, you cannot get a new unit in the same area if you are unemployed.
So is it a kind of forced gentrification where you bring in more affluent people and then move out a certain number of less affluent to other areas?
I think if ever there was an example of state-led gentrification, I think this would be one of them. There are many challenges, but one of them is that there is not very much attention on what happens to these people who are being moved out. You have to, by legislation, offer them an alternative unit, but what happens from then on is not addressed. So there is no attention on how do we secure that we, in the long run, have enough affordable housing in Denmark. There is also no attention on the fact that with this legislation, you hit the people who have the least opportunities in the housing market the most, also the people who are the most deprived. And there is not really any assistance in terms of how will these people fare after they have moved out.
You've spoken to people living in these communities. What's their reaction to this plan?
The vast majority of these people are very pleased with living where they live. So for them, this is mainly a matter of being deprived of something, of neighborhoods, of relations, of a feeling of home. They are also living through quite a long period of time where they don't know what's going to happen, where people are moving around them, where they don't know if it's them or someone else who has to move. But also, the second problem is that it doesn't feel like it's being done for them. And that's also true. It's not being done for them. It's being done for those more affluent people that the government wants to move into the areas. So we spoke to someone who said, well, the playground, that's not for my children. That's for the new children. That this is being done for someone else's sake, not for our sake.
Rikke, do you support this program?
I wouldn't say that I support the program. That would be the easiest answer. I do think that there are some of these areas where you needed something to happen and where local actors were not doing enough yet. But I think it's much too large scale a plan, which is too focused on everyone else but the
current residents, and it's taking it to a unprecedented level that's not necessary in most of these areas, at least.
We've been speaking to Rekha Skovgaard-Nielsen. She's a senior researcher at Aalborg University in Denmark, and she joined us from Copenhagen. Thanks for taking the time, Rekha.
You're welcome.
Sweden and Switzerland, two very different countries, right? Well, it turns out not everyone is so sure. Every year, according to Sweden's main tourism body, tens of thousands of people Google the question, are Sweden and Switzerland the same? Now Sweden has come up with a solution. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry has more.
Leaders and citizens of Switzerland, this is a message from Sweden. We're contacting you regarding our mutual problem.
This is the latest video campaign by Visit Sweden, the country's national tourism organization. The woman is standing in front of a podium. Two large Swedish flags are perched behind her, and she's holding up a newspaper with the headline, "The President's Blooper Mixed Up Sweden and Switzerland." She doesn't actually say it, but many people are assuming she's talking about this.
And we've invited two new members to join NATO. Some of the American press will remember when I got a phone call from the leader of Finland saying, could he come and see me? And he came the next day. We got the telephone. He suggested we call the leader of Switzerland. Switzerland, my goodness, I'm getting really anxious here about expanding NATO. Of Sweden.
President Biden was quick to correct himself. The New York Stock Exchange in 2018 took a little bit longer.
At the New York Stock Exchange, hopes run high for the Swedish company. Spotify opened at almost $166 per share.
On the morning the Swedish music streaming service went public, the stock exchange flew the distinctive red and white flag of Switzerland from the top of its Wall Street building. Scandinavian Twitter erupted, and a short time later, a blue and yellow flag was hoisted up instead. For Swedes, though, this confusion is nothing new. Niels Persson is from Stockholm, the Swedish capital. He was in New York in February.
We were a group of Swedish people traveling on the subway, and there was an elderly lady sitting on the subway, and she said, "Oh, hi, what lovely language you have. Where are you from?" "Yeah, we're from Sweden." "Oh, I love that place. I love Zurich. It's such a wonderful city."
Zurich is Switzerland's main financial hub. Persson says he's heard comments like this all his life. He's chief marketing officer with Visit Sweden, the tourism group. On the same trip, Persson says, when he asked for directions to the Swedish embassy, he was sent to the Swiss one instead. But it's not just Americans who muddle the two countries up. A few years ago, France played Switzerland in a Champions Hockey League match. At the start of the game, as the two sides lined up to face each other on the ice, the French host played the national anthem of the opposing team. Only when the Swiss players started looking around bemused and the Swiss fans began to boo, did the French side realise they were blasting out Sweden's national anthem. Persson says the Brits get confused too. In a recent survey, they asked people in Britain about one of Sweden's most famous exports.
The winner takes it all, the loser standing small, beside the victory, that's a destiny.
They knew they had a problem, he says, when 15% of Brits said they thought ABBA came from Switzerland. Persson says he's not sure exactly why the two countries get mixed up so much, aside from the fact that, well, both do begin with the same two letters. But he says he does have some sympathy for the Spanish. I asked my Spanish friend Patricia Martinez in Madrid to pronounce the two countries' names for me.
In Spain, we say for Sweden, Suecia, and for Switzerland, Suiza.
The Portuguese, Niels Persson says, have a similar problem. The two countries just sound really alike in those languages. So Persson and his colleagues at Visit Sweden decided to start a campaign to put an end to all the confusion. In the video, they suggest to Switzerland the things the Alpine country could focus on.
Switzerland gets to promote loud noises, such as yodeling. In return, Sweden gets silence and a lack of yodeling. LSD goes to Switzerland, because you invented that. And Sweden will get the Northern Lights, a different kind of surreal experience.
Niels Persson says they haven't received any official response from Switzerland just yet, but lots of people from Austria and Australia have been in touch to say they think it's a good idea. They've had messages from residents of Idaho and Iowa too, he says. But so far, there's been no word just yet from Slovenia or Slovakia. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Spanish artist María José Yergo releases her first full-length album today. It's called Ultra Belleza. Her voice carries the legacy of flamenco, the traditional music of her homeland. But on this record, she's exploring new musical frontiers. In Barcelona, reporter Alain Ruiz Terró recently spoke to the artist and has this story.
The first song on María José Yergo's new album sounds unlike anything she's done before. It's a pop banger, propelled by a disco beat with a triumphant chorus. It's called Aprendiendo a Volar, or Learning to Fly, and it almost seems like a disclaimer for listeners, a warning that what lies ahead is a departure, an act of artistic liberation. I shed a lot of baggage of what I should or should not be, she says.
Soy lo que soy. Escribo lo que quiero, canto como quiero.
I am what I am. I write what I want, sing the way I want, and I'm not here to please anyone, she says. María José Yergo was born 29 years ago in Pozo Blanco, a rural town in Spain's southern region of Andalucía, the home of flamenco. As a child, she learned the art of flamenco from her grandfather, Pepe, who would sing to her while he worked on the field. You can hear the sound of a hoe harvesting the land in this track from her first collection of songs, which was released almost 4 years ago. The record was a way of dealing with her past traumas, like the struggle of chasing her dream to be a singer when few thought it possible. That first EP was called Sanación, or Healing.
Yo hice Sanación para sanarme. Ahora, después de Sanación,
I made Sanación to heal. After that, I was able to fly. My roots have now turned into wings, she says. The artist is flying high and far. While Sanación was deeply inspired by flamenco, Ultra Belleza is a kaleidoscope of musical influences, jumping from genre to genre, soul, R&B, electronic, or reggaeton. After making a record that sounded more like flamenco, people wanted me to continue doing that, but as an artist, I've got many more interests, she says. Whereas Sanación was melodic, Ultra Belleza is rhythmic. While one was solemn and melancholic, the other is playful and energetic, reflecting the artist's current mood.
Cuando uno está bien, quiere reírse.
When you feel good, you wanna laugh, she says. Some songs on the album may be the closest the artist has been to what one would call mainstream pop, but others are among her most experimental and daring creations to date. This is Visión y Reflejo, a song so unpredictable that as the artist was recording it, she says even she didn't know where it would take her.
Es mejor que te guíes por tu brújula interna de Dios, me encanta.
It's best to follow your inner compass, she says. And when you love something, that's the way to go. But for all the exploration, María José Hiergo has not abandoned her roots. Rather, she has found new ways of connecting with them. The influence of flamenco may not be as obvious here as in her previous works, but it's still present.
El flamenco que yo tengo se intuye en mi voz, en cada cosa que canto. Yo puedo estar cantando un estándar.
Flamenco is in my voice every time I sing, she says. Even if it's a jazz standard, you know I come from Andalucía. The lessons she learns from her grandfather beyond flamenco are also present in the album.
Me enseña a querer a los demás por lo que son.
He teaches me to love others for who they are, not for what they seem or what they have, she says. This is the theme of the title track, which turns a religious prayer into a hymn for acceptance. Ultrabelleza, she says, is the place we would reach if we understood differences in our society as something not bad, but which make us richer. For The World, I'm Alan Rusterol, Barcelona.
Thanks for spending part of your Friday with us. We send you into the weekend with more music by María José Hiergo. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org, where you can explore our reporting, learn about our team of journalists, and subscribe to our daily podcast so you never miss a beat. Find all of that at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.
From PRX.